A quick disclaimer before we proceed with this week's episode of Travolta Cage. We recorded this episode over two different sessions because we lost some audio and had to re-record a segment. As such, there may be some technical difficulties with some of the audio tracks. We apologize for the inconvenience, and it will be better in future episodes. Enjoy.
I can eat a page for hours.
Do you want lunch?
You're A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
I can't talk too long. I gotta poo.
Oh, no, no, not the bees! Not the bees! Ah!
It's like looking in a mirror, only not.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of Effin' Birds Presents Travolta Cage, a podcast about the two greatest actors in movie history. I'm Clint Worthington. I'm a senior writer for Consequence of Sound and the founder and editor-in-chief of The Spool.
And my name is Nathan Raben. I am the proprietor of the website Nathan Raben's Happy Place, the author of a number of books, most recently The Weird According to Al, The Ridiculously Self-Indulgent, Ill-Advised Vanity Edition, and the co-host of this here podcast.
And for those of you who still need an explanation as to what we do here, we are fascinated by the filmographies of John Travolta and Nicolas Cage, two of the most crazy, interesting, weird guys who have ever graced an American movie screen in the latter half of the 20th century and up to today. So what Nathan and I are doing are going chronologically through the filmographies of both actors, each taking one Travolta and one Cage movie to see how their paths and thematic interests intertwine and diverge. And this week we're joined by a wonderful guest, Joe Berkowitz. Hello, Joe.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Why don't you tell the people what you do and where they can find you doing it?
Sure. I'm a writer and editor at Fast Company. I do some pop culture reporting there, and then I also do opinion columns about the politics. And in my spare time, I'm also an author, and I just put out a new book called American Cheese, which is kind of a narrative journey through the American artisan cheese world, but there's jokes in it.
Excellent. I love it. I love cheese. I love books. That sounds right up my alley. Now, we've brought you here for a very special double feature in that we're finally reaching the beginnings of a very special time for both of these actors when they start doing action movies. Now, only one of them is an action movie per se. The other is more of a film noir thriller in the vein of a lot of Cage movies he's done before. But yeah, this week we're going to be talking about John Woo's Broken Arrow and the Barbet Schroeder film noir remake Kiss of Death.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's very, very exciting. But before we talk about either of those, I do want to point out that we do have a Patreon, patreon.com/TravoltaCage. Please pledge whatever you'd like to help us keep the lights on. It would be very, very much appreciated. I'm thinking that we should start actually giving patrons content. So I know that there's a little movie called Jiu-Jitsu coming up. And I feel like we should watch that and maybe do a patron-only podcast for our lovely patrons reviewing that.
That is an excellent idea, and I just want to just kind of bring up the elephant in the room, what's going on in the culture that everybody's talking about. Today was the day Quibi went away.
Oh, no.
That's right, Quibi. The very, very well-thought-out app, billion-dollar app, in which they had, 8-minute shows? It is no longer with us. And our goal with the Travolta Cage was to outlast Quibi. And we're won. We're victorious. We're victorious. It's actually appropriate to this podcast because if you look at John Travolta's IMDb page, which sadly nobody does these days, his only credit for 2020 was a Quibi movie, TV, what the fuck these things are, called a Die Hard. And the only amount of trivia on Die Hard is originally written for Bruce Willis. But Willis didn't understand the concept of Quibi. and turned it down, replaced by John Travolta. And I have a hard time believing.
That's the most relatable I've found Bruce Willis in years.
I think this is the probably the only time that John Travolta's name has been associated with a failure.
Oh, right, right, right. That's
first, probably the last time that John Travolta and failure have been mentioned in the same sentence.
Quite so. But congratulations to us for outlasting and probably having more money now at this point than Quibi.
Truly, the quickest bite of all was the collective bite we all took of the streamer before spitting it out and saying, no, thank you.
Yeah, the bite stood for bite me. Yeah.
And for billions lost. That was the other thing that Quibi stood for. Billions lost in a quick fashion. That's what it stood for.
Indeed, indeed. So hopefully we'll see Die Hard in some fashion so we can cover it on the show. Wherever they're going to, like,
we have a very small amount of time.
I know. I think they're going to try to shop around this content to other platforms. And it's like, do we want to turn our TVs sideways? I'm not sure how that works. But without further ado, let's dig into the movies at hand, starting with Broken Arrow.
They are America's first line of defense. Best of friends.
Ready, Captain? Map of the Earth. Here we go.
Fierce competitors.
Very nicely done. Almost as good as me.
Ready to protect our nation against any threat.
Carrying the nukes. You love having the power of God at your fingertips.
Not tonight, buddy.
But what if the enemy is one of them?
What the hell are you doing?
We got pilots down.
Over here! We got ourselves a broken arrow.
A broken what? What we call it when we lose a nuclear weapon.
I don't know what's scarier, losing nuclear weapons, or that it happens so often there's actually a term for it.
The only thing more dangerous than what he knows.
They believe they've got an exposed core.
They gotta send in a nuclear emergency search team. By the time they find us, we'll be gone.
Is what he's prepared to do.
$250 million by 0900 Utah time. If you have not...
Good God. I don't know what the big deal is. I really don't.
But there's one thing.
Smile, boys. We're about to retire.
He didn't count on.
I know his mind works. You gotta let me go after him.
Outstanding, Hal. That's the spirit.
Would you mind not shooting at the thermonuclear weapons?
And what are we doing?
If you enter the wrong code three times, the nuke goes dead.
Unless, of course, I already thought of that ahead of time.
You just activated a nuclear warhead, my friend.
Is ticking.
Care for a Coke or something?
John Travolta.
You lose.
Christian Slater.
You're out of your mind.
Ain't it cool?
Broken Arrow, a John Woo film.
Now, Nathan, why don't you describe to me the atmosphere, the verve, the joie de vivre that is Broken Arrow?
Sure. This was John Woo's second American film. He did this after Hard Target, which is a wonderful, wonderful film. I know we have many, many wonderful memories about it. My favorite is probably that Jean-Claude Van Damme's character was named Chance. And I said, why are you named Chance? And he said, because my mama took one when she had me.
And then also Wilford Brimley.
Exactly, Wilford Brimley was riding around on a horse, speaking in the world's heaviest Cajun accent. So this was his follow up to that. So it was a bigger movie, bigger stars, bigger kind of epic budget. So yeah, this is a movie about honor and glory and dignity. And it starts off with John Travolta and Christian Slater, who are the stars of this motion picture. They're in a boxing match and they're fighting, and John Travolta is very conveniently telling Christian Slater what he's going to do, how he's going to do it, what he's going to do after he does what he says he's going to do. And this is sort of like occupies the role that a chess match plays in every other film, where it's what's called an allegory. And it's a metaphor. And you know it's an allegory and a metaphor because it punches you in the face with its allegorical ramifications, the same way that John Travolta punches Christian Slater in the face over and over and over again. And they are two hotshot pilots in the Air Force, and they have this mission to fly a stealth on like a secret experimental mission. They're supposed to go very, very low with two nuclear weapons, and during the course of this, John Travolta, sort of a switch goes off in him, and he goes from being somebody who is about to be revealed as a huge villain to somebody who is revealed as a huge villain. He releases the nuclear missiles. He punches Christian Slater in the face, as we all want to do in the 90s and today in the late 80s. And then there is a kind of a mad scramble where Christian Slater teams up with Princess Peach. Samantha Masses, who you all know from the Super Mario Brothers game. You also might know her from the motion picture Pump Up the Volume. And Pump Up the Volume stars Christian Slater as Hard-On Harry and Samantha Masses as love interest. So I like to think of this as being a sequel, a flat-out sequel, and if not that, at least a spiritual sequel. So basically, 5'9" Christian Slater, who looks like, you know, he's been, most of his exercise consists of chain smoking, and Princess Peach, they take on John Travolta and Howie Long in the performance that somehow convinced studio executives that he was a movie star in the making, and that Joe and Jane America wanted to spend $14 to go to the multiplex to see the new Howie Long movie. And then, yeah, in the third act, things get very big and very crazy as they struggle to control this runaway nuclear bomb and prevent the deaths of millions and millions of people. And yeah, this is a very, very silly movie, a very operatic movie, a very stylish movie, a movie with a very big, very enjoyable John Travolta performance, kind of at the beginning of sort of embracing villainy, embracing theatricality, embracing just a sort of scenery-eating sort of campiness. I was also kind of struck that we sort of are currently inhabiting the era of the action movie behemoth. You know, I feel like sort of your Chris Hemsworth is sort of the template for a modern action star. So it's very interesting seeing a tiny little man like Christian Slater do a lot of action. And apparently he did all of his own stunts, which is very impressive to me because it seems like, you know, his stunt double would have had as much on-screen time as he did. I mean, there's a moment where he, like, leaps onto the top of a train, and then he kicks Howie Long, professional NFL superstar Howie Long, through the back of a train to his death, thousands of feet below. So it was it's fascinating to me, yeah, that they made a movie in which the heroes are of average size and average height, or shorter. Were either of you struck by that, at how relatively slight the heroes of this motion picture are?
Well, I mean, they only look slight next to Howie Long, you know? When they're next to each other, they look, you know, normal, because you can't tell, there's no control group.
Yeah. But even John Travolta is a tall man. I feel like whenever John Travolta and Christian Slater are together, John Travolta seems, and I think part of it too is he's supposed to be more intimidating, sort of physically, and then kind of like from an iconic performance standpoint as well.
Well, then we're also more used to, we're used to lankier action heroes, you know, like Tom Cruise is short as hell and he's like one of the biggest action stars in the world. I keep remembering when like the Jack Reacher movie came out and people raised a stink because the character in that book is like 6 foot something. But like there is something to the short, punchy fight aesthetic of someone like a Tom Cruise, or in this case, Christian Slater, who's doing this. And also that matches a lot more with John Woo's action aesthetic coming from Hong Kong cinema, where it is much more balletic and it's much more sort of martial arts influenced, where there are the bullet operas and things like that. He's not very big usually on like the punchy hulky wrestler kind of vibe, you know what I mean? I couldn't imagine a Dwayne the Rock Johnson John Woo movie, So it feels like in that respect, Christian Slater is like the short, wiry guy kind of hopping around with two guns trying to save the day.
And he is 14 years younger than John Travolta. So it's a little weird to see them as like fighter pilot peers who one of them just hasn't advanced in their career and they're just kind of struggling together at the same level. That was a little funny to me.
That's true. But also there's kind of a big brother, little brother dynamic between them. I think that from the beginning too, like even with the boxing thing, like John Travolta has the air of that know-it-all older brother who wants to lord his authority and sort of like at least like physical power over Christian Slater. And so in that respect, in as much as you can impose sort of themes and narrative onto this, this is kind of a movie about Christian Slater's character overcoming that and like coming out on his own as his own man, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love how they try to show the chemistry of them with this guitar-based music stinger that just always comes up. And the way it's the same exact music from Scream 2 that comes on every time Dewey and Gale Weathers, David Arquette, Courtney Cox, every time they're on Scream together, that music is there as a bed to kind of like show that chemistry is happening here. And I only noticed this because I saw Scream 2 the other day. So I was like, what the hell? But they did come out 1 year apart from each other, that movie and this movie.
Yeah, and I actually just saw Scream 2 as well. And I got to say, Scream 2, really good movie. And you're right, it is literally at the exact same sting. And apparently it's Duane Eddy, who I believe is a pretty prominent surf guitarist. And I think part of it was to kind of add sort of an Ennio Morricone quality to it. And I think, you know, you mentioned themes. Like, this is a John Woo movie, so of course there are going to be themes. And I felt like one of the themes of it is that it's sort of a modern-day Western, if I might be very hackneyed and very cliched, where it's kind of a military modern-day Western. A lot of it takes place in the desert. You kind of have your red hat with John Travolta and your white hat, Christian Slater. It definitely felt like it had that quality to it. I also felt like this is a movie that starts off a little bit cheesy. No, this starts off incredibly cheesy. It gets more impressively cheesy. It's distractingly cheesy. At the very beginning of it, there's Frank Whaley. There are all sorts of people here who were in Travolta and Cage movies before. But Frank Whaley has a very, very silly role as kind of like the, you know, sort of the big brain in the government. And Kurtwood Smith is playing his superior. And he's like,
Frank Whaley's kind of the John Cusack and Con Air of this movie.
Pretty much. And he says, you know, he says, wow, you're so good. You scare me. And he says, I'm so good, I scare myself. And it reminded me of the line in The Avenging Disco Godfather, where the cop says to The Avenging Disco Godfather, he goes, I don't get you, Godfather. And he goes, I don't get me either. And he's so serious, and he takes it like, ooh, this is my big Oscar moment. And it's absolutely ridiculous. And I felt like, there is certainly an element of that. And I felt like sort of as the movie goes along, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And John Travolta's performance gets incredibly operatic. You know, it gets incredibly quotable. I felt like this is a movie that ends a lot more strongly than it begins. And I feel like that's the antithesis of Kiss of Death, where it sort of roars out of the gate and then by the end isn't quite as ferocious as it began. What did you guys think? Do you think this gained steam as it went along?
I think it gained steam that as it went along, because I mean, I did like that. There's a whole sort of lot of setup that has to happen. And I actually read in the IMDb trivia that there was supposed to be a 2-hour cut of this that had more character development and more violence in the action scenes. And I can't help but feel like some of that time could have been taken away from, again, like, you know, we mentioned this sort of a military movie. This is one of those action thrillers in the mid 90s that was all about like people in suits in like military uniforms and rooms, like talking and talking and talking endlessly while the real action's happening. And so like when it comes down to Frank Whaley or Delroy Lindo or Kurtwood Smith, there's like endless scenes of just talking. When you like, you know that no one cares about this stuff, right? I was counting the minutes until Christian Slater and John Travolta were back on screen. And you mentioned like the quotability of Travolta, and the more operatic he gets as the movie goes on. That whole final act on the train with "Yeah, ain't it cool?" and just like Travolta's having the time of his goddamn life. And I just think that's when like the schlocky potential of Broken Arrow truly takes shape.
Speaking of operatic, the moment we find out, as Nathan said, that, you know, that Travolta, from the moment we cross over from he's going to be a bad guy to he is, we have Christian Slater saying, "You love having the power of a nuke at your fingertips. You get off on it." And then close up of John Travolta's evil eyes narrowing as a children's choir hits the high note. That's the
offer
for you right there.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Oh, it's so great.
Oh, we've talked about some of the manly men in the supporting cast there, and I very much enjoyed Bob Gunton, who a lot of you people know from Shawshank Redemption. He plays the bad guy who bankrolled this, so he's kind of a middle manager, and he's always getting on John Travolta's nerves, and it's a very funny dynamic to me, because he's like, "Oi, this is getting out of control. Why can't this run smoothly? Like, why can't this be a well-oiled operation? I'm like, you're stealing a nuclear weapon to blackmail the government for $250 million. You're not painting a house. There are going to be a bunch of variables here, you know? So yeah, I felt like, yeah, kind of the dynamic between...
Yeah, Bob Gunton's kind of the bad guy that Travolta has to kill to become the main bad guy.
Yeah. But I liked how much of a middle manager he was. And I liked how he was mostly just like, "Oh, I'm just trying to get a return on my investment. And I'm annoyed that you're a complete psychotic, you know? Why do I have to deal with all these variables? Can't this just run smoothly like we planned?"
Right, exactly. And then, of course, we have Samantha Mathis, who I actually thought was pretty good in this. Like, I think in the pantheon of 90s action movie love interests, she's very much in the Sandy Bullock mold, which apparently she asks Sandy Bullock for advice doing all these action scenes. And Sandra Bullock's advice to her was to hum the James Bond theme before you did anything like action-y, which I think is great. But I just appreciate that she didn't have to be a bimbo, and she's sort of like in her role in Super Mario Brothers, she gets to hang out in a bunch of like L.L. Bean cargo shorts kit, which is all really fun.
You know who they wanted? They offered this role to Helen Hunt. They offered this to Helen Hunt, and Helen Hunt went off to go make Twister instead. Which is another kind of interesting place where kind of Travolta and Cage's filmographies overlap.
Right. And even in this very episode. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's so interesting because, I mean, one of the things about John Woo movies is there is such a, you know, every single emotion, every single movement is heightened. There's like close ups and zooms to like displays and furrowed brows and everything else. But one thing I did sorely miss are doves. I don't remember a single dove in this movie.
Yeah, I didn't see Dove One.
Yeah,
but I mean they do have a fair amount of smoke, you know. They do have a lot of slow motion. There are a fair number of standoffs, and yeah, I kind of feel like sort of with the exception of Face Off, that John Woo felt a little limited, you know, while he was making American movies. That there was something in the way of him achieving, you know, the ultimate kind of greatness that he had in Hong Kong. And I felt like, yeah, this is a very fun movie. Just sort of like Hard Target is a very fun movie. But it's not necessarily on the same level or in the same league as his Hong Kong films.
Well, because with the exception of Van Damme, he never really had an action star, like a guy who was an action guy first and an actor second, leading his movies, you know, like in the case of Travolta and Cage, they were actors first who transitioned into action. Whereas, you know, so, you know, he would have to sort of Americanize and dumb it down, because if you go to Hong Kong, you know, you have your Chow Yun-Fat, who have the chops to be able to like run down a flight of stairs shooting two pistols in each hand, you know? So whenever it comes time to do all this stuff, he has to fit the square peg into the round hole of macho American cinema. And it doesn't quite take a lot of times.
What's interesting too is, like, if this is the beginning of John Travolta action guy, it's also the beginning of John Travolta villain. And so it's like, this seems, you know, a good warm up for him in Face Off, where when he's you know, the bad guy, his monologues are a bit more juicier and they're more lived in. And it's also the warm up for Swordfish, which is by no means the better movie than either of these, but, you know, he's, by then he's like gone full ham. Not that he's not hammy enough here.
Right, right. And yeah, there's a sense of, like, you know, he's always been hammy because he's always been this consummate showman. He's always been a very theatrical performer. But with these, like, grand villain roles, he always gets, like you said, those delicious monologues where he can just sort of, like, smirk and just be very quippy and occasionally yelp certain parts of the sentence, basically. And yeah, there's something really appealing about that. And I think he really makes the most of that here. I think my favorite moment with him, though, is his very final demise, which is the most John Woo moment in the entire movie, where the train crashes and stops. And so the nuclear bomb that he was going to set off the whole movie comes jetting towards him. And it seems to take an eternity. And it takes long enough that he can stand all the way up and stare at it with a bizarre grin on his face, knowing that he's going to die, but is going to just have a hell of a time doing it for about 5 straight seconds before he, like, gets hit and flings out of the train car.
Like, well, this is an ironic ending for me.
Well, they say
wrestle
if
the
you
call
live-
back to the $20 bill as though that's, like, the ultimate sign that he's gone.
Well, I also like kind of the idea that this is sort of like the game, and that this is the way in which he teaches Gretchen Slater that he needs to be a little bit more aggressive. He needs to not play by the rules, and the way that he does it is by nearly murdering hundreds of millions of people. And being
he's the Sean Penn
insane.
Of this, yeah.
Which is all ironic, since his big goal was to help Volvo make the safest automobiles in the world.
Yeah, I love that nest egg plan of his.
What was up with that? I understand, like,
take the money.
That is my favorite part of the screenplay, is when he says that, yeah, that he's doing this so that he can buy 5% of Volvo, and then he will have the pride of knowing that he is involved in the manufacture of the safest automobiles in the world. And I felt like if Joss Whedon or J.J. Abrams came in that one day and that was their one line, good job. You earned your $50,000. That is, yeah, very. And it's funny, actually, I found out that looking on IMDb that apparently he takes off his military uniform when he turns into a super bad guy because the military told him to. Because they're like, yeah, we're not going to give you any assistance unless you clearly articulate, I can't be a bad guy if I'm wearing a U.S. Military uniform. And it checks out. There have been no bad people in the government or in the military ever.
Right, exactly. And also, again, you know, the military stuff, it felt very much like that kind of Jerry Bruckheimer, Don Simpson, pre-Michael Bay love of the military stuff, you know, with, you know, the fact that it's named after, the title refers to a specific kind of military jargon, where a broken arrow is a reference to a nuke that has been lost, and you don't know where it is, and it feels like that title, it was named after that to teach people what that meant.
I think it's interesting to know that, like, this was an era in which the stealth bomber was like a celebrity plane. Like, Children knew about this super cool plane that was incredibly expensive and that could fly under radar. Like, that is some fucked up Starship Trooper worship of the military bullshit going on.
Oh, yeah, because this is post-Gulf War when we were first really starting to use airplanes and stuff. Because I remember growing up as a kid, my parents got me a box of, like, Gulf War trading cards that had, like, Air Force planes on them, so like I knew what an A-10 Warthog was and that stuff, so yeah, that feels very much in tune with the kind of milporn jingoism
as featured in the movie Garden State.
Oh yes.
Peter Sarsgaard's character, his big eccentricity is that he collects Gulf War cards, and it symbolizes how, like, life, man.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
The kinks, you know? but anyway, I don't know. Do we have any final thoughts on Broken Arrow? Because it's tough, because it's real schlocky fun. I feel like it gets more fun in the latter half once, like, the the gears start to really turn, and like John Woo can actually get away with, you know, blowing up a bunch of stuff and having Christian Slater run around with two guns. Before that, it takes a while to get going, but like, yeah, there's an energy to it that I always dig.
I enjoyed the stuff blew up, but good.
It did. Stuff blew up good. We get a nuclear weapon to the chest as a kill. We get a guy getting shot and then falling in a fire. That's fun.
Yes.
But one thing I want to say is I love that this movie starts out with one of my favorite kinds of expository dialogue, which is, you said so yourself. You should have made Colonel by now, but you're too busy pushing at everybody all the time. So I love that kind of thing. I wanted to say that a broken arrow is a pretty understated term to describe a lost nuclear weapon situation.
Yeah, they're big on euphemism, I guess, in the U.S. military.
Oh, yeah. And then finally, I wanted to say that that every now and then, John Travolta, he does this like black scent kind of thing. And at one point he says, I say, God damn, what a rush. And I don't know. It just seems so odd with like the rest of his villainry that I don't know if that was like a choice that he made because Uma Thurman says, I say, God damn, when she like hits a line of coke in Pulp Fiction, which he was also in. I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like that's something he has affected before. We talked a few episodes ago about White Man's Burden, the racial allegory film where he played, where like the races were reversed and it was white people who were oppressed. And he kind of puts on one for that, too.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that movie. So did the world.
Everyone did. It's OK. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we should mention, too, that sort of I was just saying that Ain't It Cool News apparently got its name from the moment in this where I think Christian Slater is, oh my God, you're completely insane. It's crazy, man. And John Travolta goes, I know, ain't it cool?
Yeah, yeah, ain't it cool? That was a very trailer moment.
Yeah, I was wondering about that because the timing lines up. This was right around the time that website started.
Yep, yep. What a strange legacy this movie leaves behind.
Starting from a pump up the volume reunion to inspiring a young Harry Knowles to go make magic.
Indeed. And and some other things.
yeah.
Some less than kosher. All right. Well, speaking of leaving things behind, we should probably move on to our second film of the evening because the cage half of this podcast still needs to happen. So I don't know if you remember a little TV actor in the 90s named David Caruso, who was hot off NYPD Blue, but he decided to go into movies. And one of his first big breakouts in the movie field was Kiss of Death.
Jimmy, I'm a dead man. I know you don't want to be involved, but I don't know what else to do, all right?
I'm your blood cousin, Jimmy. I'm your blood cousin. You know that. Please don't let this happen.
You want a little air on this? Give me some names.
There was no way on God's green earth that you can tell me that you did not know the guy who got you into this mess.
I've got no reason to lie. Everybody's got a reason to lie.
Whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right? Whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
I like that.
Did you ever hear about Little Junior Brown? It looks like Little Junior's moving up in the world.
Cars, drugs, guns. He's buying everything he can get his hands on.
Big Junior. That's one of those expressions like jumbo shrimp.
Oh my, the cars.
Man, I take them all except that Explorer.
What's the matter with the Explorer?
It's red. Red's my bad luck color. I ain't got nothing to do with Rick.
Are you a man of honor?
Sure.
24.
If I serve him up.
Jeez, what you been eating?
When you say to me now, you will cut me loose for all time.
Absolutely.
Do you want my hand on it or something?
If you take that wow off one more time, I'm personally gonna beat you to death.
Maybe the next time you lay a hand on me, it won't be such a one-way beating.
Ronnie, I want you to listen to this. An oldie but goodie.
Time's come for everyone to clean up their own backyard.
Hey, the bass is too heavy now.
This mother smells scared, Junior.
You do nothing, Miller!
You got something to say!
I will do whatever I have to do to protect me and mine.
Don't push, all right?
It's been a hard week. All I want now is what I had in my life before you and them.
Now is not the time, my man, but I'm gonna see you real soon.
See me now.
Tomorrow, just come by the bar. We should have a conversation about life and stuff.
Joe, describe to me the plot of Kiss of Death.
Sure, yeah. Kiss of Death is your classic, every time I think I'm out, they pull me back in kind of deal, with David Caruso making the courageous leap from NYPD Blue to the silver screen. He and his wife, Helen Hunt, have just gotten out of some kind of horrible experience together that we find out more about later, but their life is on the right track. And then kind of degenerate blood cousin of Caruso's, Michael Rapaport, Zebrahead himself, comes rolling in. And he seems like a very sympathetic character at first. He needs Caruso's help doing something involving trucks one night. And Caruso extremely reluctantly agrees because it is more than implied that Rapaport will lose use of his legs or possibly brain if he doesn't get the help he needs. So the thing he needs him to help with is a job for the awesomely named Little Junior Brown, Nick Cage's character. An absurdly jacked Nick Cage. And wouldn't you know it, the job goes wrong immediately. Like 5 minutes into it, it goes wrong already just because they're stopped by cops and that wasn't, you know, in the brochure. But more so, the guy that Caruso is replacing is this drunk loser who is passed out in the seat. And when he comes to and sees that Caruso is talking to a cop played by Samuel L. Jackson, he flips out and shoots Samuel Jackson in the face, but not before Caruso goes, "No!" and like hits his hand and takes a bullet in the hand. And yeah, and even though he literally takes a bullet for Samuel Jackson, there's not much forgiveness there later on.
It's a very Christ-like moment when he does that.
Yeah.
Very
stigmata. Yeah.
It would have been very funny and very prescient if after he did that, he took off his sunglasses and said to Samuel Jackson, "Glad to lend you a hand."
Yeah! anyway, yeah.
Yeah, Caruso is in jail because, you know, he won't give up his cousin or anyone else. And then once he's in jail, we find out what a slime ball Rapaport actually is. And he, you know, ropes Helen Hunt into working for him and is just generally sleazy in a bunch of ways until Helen Hunt dies from it. She memorably drives into oncoming traffic on accident, not before shouting Caruso's character's name, Jimmy, you know, before her demise. Then Caruso spends the rest of the movie getting even in various ways. I don't know how much more detail I should get into than that, but yeah, that's the movie.
Yeah, exactly. So, this is a remake of a film noir from the 40s, and it's directed by Barbet Schroeder of Single White Female fame, and this very much has, like, his sort of melodramatic footprints all over it. And we should mention again, like, you know, this is a Nick Cage movie, but he is not the star. The star is NYPD Blue alum David Caruso, who I didn't even realize quit after the first season, right? Or like second season to like start a movie career.
It was a real Chevy Chase moment.
Like, just way to look a gift horse in the mouth. And then, of course, he had to come crawling back to TV for the sunglasses and they won't get fooled again. But yeah, it's interesting because this had a very lukewarm reception, I think, when it came out. Like, you know, much like most of Caruso's movies. But there is some like interesting stuff here, especially around Cage, who's just much like a previous Travolta Cage recipient, Deadfall, is easily the most interesting character in this dark, gritty crime world of like fools and criminals.
1,000%. And then also, not only is he not the lead, he gets the and credit. It's like, and Nicolas Cage is Lil Junior Brown. I was ready for him to like barely be in it, but he's definitely like either the second lead or third.
I feel like Nick Cage is going to be the first movie star to get the or credit.
I like that, but that and it's a credit of distinction. And again, he doesn't have that much of a role in the first half of the movie, which kind of focuses on Michael Rapaport, who is this is a wonderful, wonderful moment where David Caruso, because you know Michael Rapaport's character tried to have sex with his wife, possibly succeeded in that endeavor, leading to her death. He goes from stop snitching to start snitching. Oh, hell yes. Oh, hell yes. So he snitches, and it results in Michael Rapaport's character getting beaten to death. And this is a wonderful, wonderful 1995 New York moment in which he is beaten to death by Nicolas Cage to the sounds of House of Pain's Jump Around. And this is transcendent cinema. And Michael Nicolas Cage makes so many interesting choices in this role. He always makes interesting choices in everything that he does in life as well as in movies. And one of those is when he's punching Michael Rapaport to death, he goes, ow! And it's this really weird, interesting, humanizing moment, and it feels like very realistic as well, as if you were beating somebody literally to death with your fist, if you were turning their face into hamburger meat, like that would hurt you as well. Like that would just be really, really painful. And yeah, I think the first time that we're actually introduced to Little Junior Brown, he is literally bench pressing a bodacious babe because he works out of this strip club called Baby Cakes. And he's got this fascinating sort of homemade philosophy. It's very, there's something kind of weird and sweet and kind of childlike about it. One of which is he's a big believer in acronyms. And he has an acronym that doubles as kind of his mantra, his philosophy of life. And that is BAD, B-A-D, which stands for Balls, Attitude, Direction. So it is a role full of incredibly audacious choices. And one of the things that I love about it that sort of Nicolas Cage brings to this and every other role that he has is this weird sort of vulnerability and this sort of tenderness. And he's like this macho man. He's kind of this brute, this caveman, this Neanderthal. But he really loves his father, who's Big Junior Brown, played by the great Philip Baker Hall. And again, it just kind of adds a sort of weird tenderness, a sort of weird sweetness, this weird vulnerability. He also spends a surprising amount of time trying to be David Caruso's friend. And there's just something very, very poignant about middle-aged men trying to become friends, especially we're in this sort of very violent, hyper-masculine kind of realm.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you mentioned Philip Baker Hall a little bit ago, and we should mention how stacked the cast is. I mean, we've already mentioned a bunch of huge names, and you mentioned Helen Hunt, Joe. Stanley Tucci is also here as this district attorney who wants to use this opportunity to take down, to sort of work with David Caruso to at first take down Little Junior Brown or whatever, but it ends up, you know, trying to use it to boost his judgeship. Chances, he wants to advance his career. And it's very much that film noir thing where everyone's sort of fucking each other over in different ways, whether no matter what side of the law you're on. But the only people who seem to be on the straight and narrow are now David Caruso and Sam Jackson, who have to have that sort of erstwhile partnership near the end, which I thought came in like a lot later than I thought it would be, considering they're the two main names on the cast list.
Well, David Caruso, come on. And it's funny because I was like, why did it take me so long to watch this movie? I love, you know, Nicolas Cage. I love David Caruso. Everybody does. Everyone wanted to support him, you know, once he graduated from being a television star. And I think part of it was just that it had one of the most boring, unimaginative posters ever, was just kind of a washed out image of David Caruso's head and then a washed out image of Nicolas Cage's head. And it's one of those posters that just says, these are two actors who are in this movie. And I'm like, that could not possibly be less interesting. And there are so many things they could have sold about this. They could have sold the Barbet Schroeder aspect. He was coming off of a couple of big successes, A Reversal of Fortune, about the wonderful hero Alan Dershowitz. And Barfly, of course, was written by Richard Price, who's a great novelist and a screenwriter, and he wrote for television as well. He wrote for The Wire. And I kind of feel like that is a good and a bad thing, and that this really feels like it was written by a novelist, and that it has a lot of plot that's very well done and also kind of weirdly uninteresting. Like, the part about David Caruso and Nicolas Cage trying to find a way in this sort of brutal dog-eat-dog world, it's very working class realism. Like, I love that part. The part about the infighting between different divisions of law enforcement, I found very uninteresting. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that takes up way too much of the third act of the film.
Yeah, there's a whole act. There's a whole sort of series of scenes, probably at least a whole 15-20 minutes that are dedicated to like a bunch of people in suits in different rooms talking about whether or not Nick Cage killing Ving Rhames' character, who we think is another criminal, only to find out that he was like a secret federal agent on a sting, on a competing sting with Stanley Tucci's group that David Caruso is part of. And then there's sort of like, again, like those meetings after meetings about whether or not this is kosher and like, what are they going to do about it? And I was just so bored during all of those things. I was like, please bring me back to Nick Cage in a goatee, in an all-white tracksuit, bench pressing ladies in, I kid you not, the most brightly lit strip club of all time.
Yeah, that's also the setting where we get a, in my estimation, pantheon-level Nick Cage freakout moment, which, it, you know, right up there with, like, Vampire's Kiss, is him jumping and grief crying in a strip club, then punching a dude out, and then jumping and crying more. And it's perfectly in tune with what we know of Little Junior Brown, but more so it's perfectly in tune with what we know about Nick Cage. Either way, it makes sense, and it's great.
Yeah. This is a really good vehicle for Cage's volatility, you know, like that teetering on the edge of like a friendly kind of avuncular presence, and then just the absolute murderous guy you've ever met. He sort of does that to the nth degree in Deadfall. Here he reins it in just enough to feel like maybe he could be a human being.
Back to Nathan's point about his vulnerability, they give him asthma, which, you know, in one way it's a little bit like it adds possibly a tinge of menace a la like Dennis Hopper in Blue Velvet. But more importantly, yeah, it makes him a human guy with a weakness. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, also, it's positive asthma representation, which we don't get a lot of. You know, there's like regular size Rudy on Bob's Burgers, and Hannibal Buress has some comedy about it, and that's about it.
Right. And it also gives Cage the actor a thing to do business with, you know, like ways to punctuate a character moment, usually a really violent one, with that intake of the inhaler.
Yeah, there's something almost sort of staccato about it. And watching this, I found myself thinking like, wow, this is kind of what Deadfall would be if it were a real movie. If it had a good screenplay and it had characters and it had things for real actors to play other than, oh, I've got like a lobster claw because some screener was on a lot of cocaine and thought that would be interesting. Like, there's actual arcs. There's also conflicts. Like, I feel like this is a well-made movie and there should be not that unusual for there to be like a very well-done crime movie. But I feel like standards have gotten so low that there is something kind of special about something like this, which is very solidly made and very well observed, even if it's not transcendent necessarily.
Yeah.
Nathan, do you think the reason you never got around to seeing it in part is because Kiss of Death is kind of a boring title and doesn't really describe the movie at all?
Yeah, I was waiting for the Kiss of Death.
I think the Kiss of Death is snitching.
Yeah, I guess.
Once you snitch in this world, either you're dead or the person you snitched on is dead.
You get stitches, yeah.
Well, and I like that kind of fatalistic aspect of it, that if you're poor and you're broke and you're working class in the United States, it's very difficult to even tread water, you know, that it just becomes more and more impossible. And once sort of criminality and once these, you know, sort of the questionable and conflicting sort of motivations of law enforcement are sort of entered into the fray, sort of this difficult situation becomes impossible. And it's sort of like a very kind of well-wrought film noir theme, which is how do you survive a world that you're not supposed to, you know, you're not supposed to survive.
Right, exactly. All of this is a long way of saying that the movie Kiss of Death wouldn't exist if we had Medicare for All. So please vote. This is probably the last episode we'll put out before the election. Oh, God.
Yeah.
8 days.
Who are you guys voting for?
Oh, you know, I'm writing in Gary Johnson. I think he's got some really good ideas.
I'm a big Kanye guy.
We can all agree, great time for a protest vote.
I think we're all going to be very surprised when Kanye ends up being our next president.
Right. Well, I don't know if you guys read this op-ed that I found the other day from the CEO of Soylent, who explains why he's voting for Kanye this year. And it really is maybe the dumbest thing I've ever read richest man on the planet.
What is Soylent other than something that they make human beings out of in a dystopian future?
Oh, this turbo nerd programmer basically made it as a complete meal replacement because basically flavor gets in the way of coding productivity. It was just it's just like this beige sludge you can drink to basically get everything you absolutely need to survive without the fuss of having anything with any flavor or interest. So that's the kind of perspective that you're looking for.
It seems like something that would be a joke, like a throwaway joke on the TV show Silicon Valley, but no, it's real.
Yeah, exactly. It's very, very terrifying. And the man, like if that op-ed is a window into that man's soul, then there's just like a blinking buffering like thing happening in his brain all the time. This is also a guy who, apropos of nothing, literally destroyed his gut so he wouldn't have to poop anymore. Like, he basically poisoned himself in order to stop pooping. I don't know. It was very weird.
A good metaphor for voting for Kanye.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah.
You're saying he's really forward-thinking when he says, endorses Kanye West for president, he realizes that everyone is a genius.
Yes. It's exactly one of those things where, like, because the op-ed actually only came out a few days ago, and it was just like, yeah, it's just the most brain dead thing you'll ever read. Maybe I'll share it somewhere. But anyway, enough about that. Let's talk about Kiss of Death.
Yeah, I wanted to pick back up for a second on how much Cage is starving for friendship with Caruso. And it just really comes across most clearly, I thought, in the scene where Cage confesses that he has a second weakness beyond the whole asthma thing, which is that he can't use a metal spoon, like any metal in his mouth, and his body goes on revolt. So he confesses that, and then like a second later, when they're ending this interaction, Cage is leaving a car, and he turns back, and he's like, I never told anyone about the metal spoon thing. that's his way of letting him know that, you know, that you and I we're simpatico now.
Right. Like the things like that and the inhaler feel like they feel so quintessentially Cage that I have to believe that Nick Cage brought those to the screenplay. Like otherwise someone just up and wrote a Nick Cage character before Cage was the meme that he is.
I was so glad that the metal thing turned into a plot point later on, because at least then like it was more than just this bizarre thing that comes up in the middle of the movie.
It becomes that like random detail you throw in that that's the way you find out that someone snitched on you, right? Because like only that person knows that detail.
So one of the things that is interesting to me about Nicolas Cage in this is I feel like he has what children have, which is this sense of what is interesting to me and what is interesting about me will be interesting to everybody else. And everybody will find this fascinating, and I should share it with people so that they can be entertained and informed as well. And what he does not realize is nobody fucking cares. Like, you care about it because it's you, but everybody else, like, that's just more white noise out in the world. And he doesn't understand that, you know, because he is a narcissist and because he is a child, that what other people are going through is much different than what he thinks. And what he's going through, people don't actually care about.
Right, exactly. Which, you know, eventually, if I find it very strange, I mean, he gets the shit kicked out of him near the end of the movie, but he doesn't die. He actually does face justice. It's a weirdly happy ending for this particular movie. At first, my brain fooled myself into thinking, oh no, wait, he dies. But then I was thinking, no, that's Zandali. So that was the wrong movie. But yeah, Kiss of Death itself, like, he gets brought to justice. David Caruso gets to sort of be free and sort of drives away and, like, you know, starts a new life. Yeah, it's a very, very strangely optimistic ending.
Yeah, it also feels a little bit like a bullshit ending. I kind of feel like this is a film noir about how hard and brutal and miserable life is. You can't be like, oh, I was recording the whole time, so everybody gets everybody's happy and I get out free. It's like, no, you can't escape. There's no happy ending for guys like this. But for whatever reason, this is a motion picture made by a major studio. They decided that everything would work out at the very end, even if it feels like a betrayal to everything that came before.
Yeah, the good old I've been recording your confession this whole time, and that will bring you to justice, Chestnut, that has been used as recently as Borat subsequent movie.
Yeah, for sure. And I would use more effectively there.
Yeah, perhaps. Yang Shimash, my wife. Anyway, do we have any final thoughts on Kiss of Death? Because it is just kind of like it's relatively solid in terms of like a 90s crime movie, but it does have that, you know, when Cage isn't on screen, it's difficult to kind of keep your attention.
I wanted to say that the acronym, because that's what Nick Cage calls it.
The acronym.
Yeah, his is Bad Balls Attitude Direction. And he asks Caruso to pick one up, and sad sack Caruso over here, he comes up with Fucked at Birth, F-A-B. And it made me think that Richard Price was possibly trying to convey the duality of man.
Well, I love Nicolas Cage's response to that. He's like, oh, Fucked at Birth, that sounds very negative. It's like, you don't have enough of a positive attitude like for me, a low-life scumbag.
Right. While we're on the subject of the acronyms, too, I want to remind our patrons and potential patrons that I want to put my money where my mouth is. I think if we get to $10,000 a month on the Travolta Cage Patreon, the pie in the skyinest Patreon goal, both Nathan and myself will get Balls Attitude Direction tattooed on some part of our body. is that a wager you're willing to make?
Yes, indeed. And because it'll never happen. And FAB as well. I will get both BAD and FAB on my – and stop stitching and start snitching. Because those are two of the messages that are confusingly put forth by this movie.
Like one knuckle – one hand has stop on the knuckles, the other has start, and you have snitching on both palms.
Yes, I love it. That's great. That's perfect. So let's make it happen. It's out in the universe now. We are manifesting it. All right. Well, now that we're done talking about both movies, it's time for the final segment of the podcast, of course, Cage Match, where we decide which of these movies is better. And strangely enough, this is a bit more of an even heat than we usually have in these episodes, where one movie is so obviously demonstrably better. So, Nathan, between Broken Arrow and Kiss of Death, which would you award this to?
You know, it's weird. We actually recorded this before, and we had to re-record it. And at that point, I have them in a dead heat. But for some reason, I'm actually going to go with Broken Arrow now. I think just because Broken Arrow has marinated in my mind in a more satisfying way. Yeah, I just feel like Broken Arrow, I had kind of marinated in my mind in a more pleasing sort of way. And I like Kiss of Death, but yeah, it's kind of faded while sort of Broken Arrow has become more impressive. So I think I'm going to go with Broken Arrow.
Okay. Joe, what about you?
Well, it's a pretty close call with these two. They both have that thing that I really like in a 90s movie where you can watch it and just kind of like roll your eyes and make fun of it the whole time. But then also they're both, you know, pretty good movies, very different. But, you know, there is a well-made John Woo movie there in Broken Arrow, and it all takes place in one day. So it, you know, goes down pretty smooth. And then this, yeah, I mean, you know, there isn't a lot of attempts at neo-noir these days. And this, well, this was made 24 years ago or whatever, so it's not exactly these days anymore. But, you know, it still works as much fun as it is to make fun of. Ultimately, I think I gotta give the edge to Broken Arrow because it is just – more fun, and this is a fun to watch downer, and so it's a very particular mood I think you gotta be in, and especially if you're having someone watch it with you, I think then you're probably gonna have a better time watching Broken Arrow.
Yeah. I think I'm going to have to give it to Broken Arrow, too. You know, as much as I have been convinced over the course of this podcast that there is merit to Kiss of Death, I was sort of like Luke cold on it when I first watched it, apart from Cage. You know, I think there's merit to it. And I think, you know, pushing aside the meta nature of sort of the overarching nature of like realizing that it's like a David Caruso vehicle and the sort of folly of that. There is a lot of really interesting stuff in Kiss of Death, but that said, I just cannot say no to some John Woo schlock. And even though there are zero doves in Broken Arrow, I think I would rewatch Broken Arrow before I rewatched Kiss of Death. And I think that might be the most important hallmark.
There's sort of a lightness to Broken Arrow that I find more pleasing and satisfying than kind of the heaviness of the substance of Kiss of Death.
There's an infectious enthusiasm to Broken Arrow that I really dig. So congratulations, Broken Arrow. You go on to whatever next round we're going on to. Before we leave, there's another question that I just thought of that I feel like we should have been asking this whole time with this podcast where we're pairing Travolta and Cage movies together. Do you think that Travolta's character in Broken Arrow and Cage's character from Kiss of Death would get along?
I would like to see them take their faces off. Yeah. Just as kind of an experiment, I think they would try to kill each other.
Ooh, I guess this also brings us to maybe a more premise relevant question: could the other actor play the other character? Like, could John Travolta be Little Junior Brown, and vice versa? Like, what would those performances be like? I think that's a question we should start asking ourselves. That is very, very interesting.
Yeah, that is a very, very good question. And I sort of feel like Nicolas Cage could play the John Travolta role in Broken Arrow without too much difficulty. He's very good at being very big. He's very good at being menacing. He's very good at being evil. I feel like John Travolta would have a harder time playing a guy like Little Junior Brown. I think part of it is he's in good shape, but he doesn't have kind of the brawny physicality that Nicolas Cage brought to that role and a bunch of other ones from very early in his career and then in the mid-90s as well. He was like absurdly jacked at the beginning, and then he was absurdly jacked in the middle. And he's not quite so absurdly jacked anymore.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that's interesting food for thought. Listeners, if you're listening, respond to us, tweet at us at Travolta Cage with what sort of Travolta movie you'd like Cage to replace him in the lead role of, and vice versa. I don't know how to say it more elegantly than that, so I'll just leave it there. And I believe we're coming to the end of this particular episode. Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. This is great.
Once again, where can people find your stuff?
I'm a writer at Fast Company, so I have stuff coming out on their website just about every day. You can follow me on Twitter, Joe Berkowitz, just like it sounds like. And I just put out a new book, American Cheese, An Indulgent Odyssey, through the Artisan Cheese World, and you can buy it wherever books are sold.
Beautiful, beautiful. All right, well, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Effin' Birds Presents Travolta Cage. You can find us at whatever your podcast platform may be, whether it's Stitcher or Spotify or what have you. Wherever you do find us, please rate us and review us. It helps us out a lot. You can follow us on Twitter at Travolta Cage. I'm on Twitter at Clint Worthing. Nathan Rabin is on Twitter at Nathan Rabin. You can also go to NathanRabin.com to read our write-ups on the movies and the podcast itself. You can email questions to us at TravoltaCagePod@gmail.com. I promise one day we will actually read them. Pledge to our Patreon at patreon.com/TravoltaCage to get all kinds of bonus goodies. We will try to do some bonus content here in the near future once Jiu-Jitsu comes out. Very excited about that.
You can also buy my latest book, The Weird According to Al, The Ridiculously Self-Indulgent Ill-Advised Vanity Edition. It is perfect for the geek in your life for Christmas gifts. You can find it on Amazon, or you can go to my website, NathanRabin.com/shop, and you can buy it directly from me, which is the preferable way of buying something, because hoo boy, do I need the money, and I need it right now.
Yes. Thank you so much for listening, and if you'll excuse me, I gotta go poo.